Coming back in with Hazel Scott, Dark Eyes. And that is her birthday, and so we play the great Hazel Scott on this day. And this is the last of our three interviews for the people seeking the Democratic nomination to be the next Attorney General. I co-hosted and asked questions in a debate at the University of Baltimore with all three of the delegates. We'll be playing that on Friday morning for you. That took place two nights ago, and we'll be playing that Friday morning early for you. So you can hear that debate and be on the web, of course, so you can listen to it as well and podcast it and hear for yourself what they're saying. We're joined in studio now by Delegate John Cardin, who represents the 11th District here in the Maryland House of Delegates, and, of course, as I said, is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General here in the state of Maryland. On the way there, reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Welcome, John Cardin. Welcome back to the studio.
Mark, it's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Counting down, we are down to, 13 days?
12 days until the election day comes to us.
Early voting starts this weekend?
Yeah, it actually starts Thursday,
actually
tomorrow.
It starts tomorrow.
10 o'clock a.m. We'll be out sign-waving tomorrow morning early.
Does that mean you can go to your polls and vote?
That means you can go to, in your county, you can go to any early voting polling place in your county.
In your county.
And there in Baltimore County, there are 8. In Baltimore City, I believe there are 5. There may actually be more. There may be 6. We got to make sure the vote gets out. By the way, speaking of voting here in Baltimore, I am the only person on the Democratic side running for statewide office from the Baltimore region. And this has got to be something that people think about when they get out to vote. I believe I'm the best person to be the next Attorney General, and I am excited to talk about that for the next few minutes. But let me say that it has been since colonial days that there hasn't been somebody in state government from a statewide perspective who's from the Baltimore region. And this is an issue of resources. It's an issue of diversity of perspective. It's something that people need to consider.
Tell me the thing is, it's an issue that it shows the dwindling power of the Baltimore region.
And that shouldn't be. Baltimore is still the medical, cultural, legal, industrial, economic, and more center of not just our state, but of the entire Mid-Atlantic region. And it needs to continue to have a base of influence.
So let's jump in here, folks. Join us here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Now, you did not get in the conversations earlier because of the intensity of the conversations and the phone jams, but please join us now at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner as we talk with John Cardin, Delegate John Cardin, who's seeking to become the Democratic nominee for Attorney General on June the 24th, which is Election Day. 410-319-8888. So, John, this is always a difficult subject because you've been dogged this whole campaign by issues that have been coming up about your absences from committees, 75% absent rate on your committee hearings, and some other issues that were raised
sure.
as well. I mean, this is and so when you people what people are doing is they're taking that, they're also taking that and putting that on top of some earlier things that happened in the Inner Harbor with using the police boat. And so the people raise the question: is John Cardin really ready for Attorney General, given all these kind of things that seem to say he has some issues to deal with before he can become AG?
Sure. And I would normally say that's a fair question, but I think it's been disingenuous of my opponents to continue to highlight in an unfair way. I did not miss 75% of the work in Annapolis, and everybody knows that. I was there every day. I missed, I believe, one day. I did not request reimbursements for that day. I went every day to Annapolis and fought for the issues for the 11th District for the citizens of the state of Maryland. As I have said, and it was supposed to be a private issue, which is why it has been uncomfortable for my opponent to talk about it this way, but that I have I'm expecting a baby in August. I had a wife in a rocky first trimester. I made a commitment to my family to make sure that the health and safety of my family came first. I made sure that I got the work done during the workday. These were late night committee votes. I did not miss any of the debates or any of the markups, any of the amendments. I took over 2,700 votes during the legislative session of 2014. When you look at all of the floor votes, all of the votes of the of amendments, conference committees, concurrence calendars, and yes, I did miss some committee votes. Not one of them was impacted by my absence. I was excused. And like every working parent, I'm trying to balance between my work obligations and my family obligations.
Just push a little further before we get into some deep, serious issues that affect this camp that are affecting the state of Maryland. We want to talk about. The Daily Record reported that the bill that you put in that would close the loophole allowing people who want to purchase handguns to take possession of weapons if the Maryland State Police haven't completed their background checks, your bill that you weren't there to fight for, to vote for, and died in committee.
Yeah, it was not in my committee, and that was incorrectly stated by my opponent. It was actually in the Judiciary Committee. It was a bill that would have dedicated tax revenue to making sure that we're actually using that money to reduce the ability for closing the loophole on getting guns out in the street. And then they are going out in the street illegally, inappropriately, and we need to make sure we close that loophole. The fact is that that the committee made us wait until 7:20 p.m., I believe it was. I had waited as long as I could, and then I had to go and take my wife to the doctor. So as every single chairman of every senatorial committee that comes to the House does, I sent my legislative director to testify on my behalf, and that happens every day in Annapolis.
So the Daily Record was wrong when they said that you, when you filed for reimbursement for 64 days, a $40 rate, you got $2,688.
I did. There were 66 days of session that we were required to be there. I was there for 64 of those 66 days. I get to Annapolis every morning, 6:30 a.m. I'm there till 6 o'clock at night. If we don't have votes, I'm there, or 5 o'clock at night, 5:30, whatever it is. If we have votes late and I am able to stay, I do. I made sure that I was there for every single important vote. And if there was a question, I would make specific arrangements. Let me try and balance that with, when you have sensitive issues that come up, you try and deal with them in sensitive ways. And my opponent had his callous treatment of a gentleman named Mark Klass, the father of a murdered child who came in to testify in favor of Jessica's Law, which he opposes. He had to wait 5.5 hours. He waited till 7 o'clock at night.
But in all fairness, this is the part that people get frustrated with, sure, politicians, politics sometimes, is the attacks that do go on. I mean, when you look at the fact checking on Jessica's Laws, I think they were wrong to attack you about not voting for Jessica's Law. That's clear from the fact check. But it's equally right to say that it's wrong to attack Brian Frosch because he really didn't oppose Jessica's Law. He opposed the maximum minimum sentences. He thought that was wrong. So, I mean, people sometimes think that whether it's watching the two of you or watching Ganser and Brown or watching two boys play in the sandbox throwing sand, instead of talking about what we really have to talk about.
I completely agree with you, and I would like to focus on the issues.
Well, let's do that.
Okay. So the fact of the matter is that I have voted consistently to make sure we're protecting our families, protecting our children. That has been a priority of my campaign for all 12 years, but for the last 5 years, I have been focusing on bullying issues, whether they be internet bullying issues, whether they be in-school bullying issues. In my law practice, by the way, you're not running to be the best legislator of the year. I had the best year of my life, and I'm proud of that this year in the legislature. But you're running to be the attorney for the state of Maryland. You have to protect the citizens. You have to enforce the laws. As a lawyer, I went after school systems when they turn a blind eye when children are being bullied, and when we have it on videotape that children are being bullied and beat up, and the teachers are not stopping these fights timely. I'm not afraid to do that and go against the grain, go against the good old boys, because the protection of our families, protection of our children is the most important thing that we can do.
What do you think the most important issues will be in the next 4 years for the Attorney General to face? The most to the top couple of issues that are going to be faced by the Attorney General in the next
continue to reduce violent crime, number one.
How does an AG even do that since it's not your purview?
Well, it certainly can be. First of all, working with the National Association of Attorneys General and doing my research with them, I have learned that the best practices across the country is creating cooperation between our state police, our local state's attorneys, our local police, and our federal authorities. We have to be very careful about issues of racial profiling and civil rights violations. But we also have to use our best practices and create a cooperation between groups that tend to have difficulty cooperating. It's happening to a degree, and it needs to continue. And I think I have the skill set and the motivation to bring everybody together right there in that office, because that's where you go against. And the Attorney General does have primary jurisdiction over gang activity, over violent crime, over the illegal drug trade and the illegal gun trade. So there is an opportunity, to go after. to go after the certain violent crimes. But at the same time, we have thank you for the water, Mark. He was offering me water for those of you. But we do have to also look at where crime is going. It is going onto the internet. And we are dealing not only with consumer protection issues, but with crime issues. I led the fight on getting rid of or criminalizing revenge porn. I led the fight to making Maryland one of the safest states in the country for kids to be online through our anti-cyberbullying legislation. This is the area where we're going. We're having a new era of drug policy. We're not focusing on spending money on putting nonviolent drug offenders in jail. We're going to use that money to focus it on reduction of violent crime. That's where the Attorney General can help in the ways that I just described.
You know, I ask this question all the time, and I just want to get a very clear answer from you, as I try to get from everybody else and try to get the other day. When the man who now sits in the office, Doug Ganser, was faced with the issue for 7 years of whether there should be a right to a lawyer at bail. And the decision was made by the highest court that, yes, that is constitutionally correct, that has to happen, and the politics intervened. The question is, if you were Attorney General, because if this happened instead of 7 years ago, this happened in the year 2015, would you have done what Doug Ganser did, which was to put two of his top attorneys dedicated for 7 years to fighting against the right for attorneys at your initial bail hearing?
The answer is, as a criminal defense attorney and as somebody, the only person with any criminal practice at all in this race, I am uniquely qualified to understand the issues that these young men have. And the fact is that every single person should have representation at a bail review. And we need to make sure that that happens. I think the court got it right. And
But would you have fought it as AG?
Well, I mean, I would have probably been counsel to the governor and the administration in explaining to them where we are, and tried to have been sharp in my criticism of fighting it as I can be. I am required to defend the state's position if it's not constitutional. And if there's not a constitutional violation, and I would be required to defend the state's position, I would do that. Whether there is a constitutional violation, there could be, and again, this is an issue of the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. I mean, we have some law here that could actually create this being a constitutional violation. And certainly if it is, I will direct the state. I will tell the state I won't defend a law that's not constitutional, or won't defend the state when the law is unconstitutional.
I'm just making clear, I'm not trying to spend the
sure.
whole time on this, but are you saying yes or no, you would or would not have pressed the case the way it was pressed against the attorneys that brought the case?
I would not have pressed it the same way, no.
And the same question about HBCUs, it comes up all the time. It came up the other day in our debate, when we were at that debate. That was another piece that the court found against the state for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And where you would have been on that. This is a huge issue because it's a very complex issue as well. We're dealing with the entire system of education here with what's happened to HBCUs historically. A, what would you have done then? But B, as Attorney General, what will you do? Because you'll be in the thick of the negotiations.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think Monday night's debate definitely revealed an important policy difference between the candidates for AG. of moderator. Was it you? Would you? Did you ask the question?
No, I was going to, but Alejandro from the Afro-American.
Alejandro asked the question. Right. He asked us if the governor chose to appeal the decision, what would we do? And Delegate Brave Boy and I both said that the decision that the state's unnecessary duplication of programs was exacerbating segregation at HBCUs and violating the 14th Amendment, that we agree with that decision wholeheartedly. Delegate Brave Boy and I said, no, we would not defend the state's position if the state decided to appeal. And Senator Frosch actually refused to answer, said it needed to be mediated. We need to look and figure out a ways to work this out. We just disagree on that.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Delegate John Cardin, who is seeking to become the next Attorney General of Maryland, seeking the Democratic nomination that you, registered Democrats, will decide on June the 24th in early voting starting Thursday.
Starting Thursday, 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, Thursday through Thursday.
So 410-319-8888, write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. We are talking with to John Cardin, who's running for to become the next Attorney General nominee. 410-319-8888 for the Democrats. So there are some other issues here, I think, that I'm curious how you would attack, if attack at all. We did a program today on the issue of lead paint and Kennedy Krieger. Some people think
good program. I listened to it.
Thank you. People talk here about the lawsuits that are going on right now, the issue of lead paint and how it's affected kids in education, kids in our prison system, whether or not the state and others should launch an investigation and perhaps sue lead companies that people are alleging knew about about the cause of lead. So what in our children's brains, what it does, and what it would do. So what would your position be on that as Attorney General?
So a couple of different thoughts. First of all, as a legislator, I have always been supportive of policies that and changing laws to make to empower people who have been impacted or who could be impacted by lead paint poisoning to make sure that they're made whole and given as much empowered rights as they can. As a lawyer, I have been very involved with making sure that the plaintiff's bar that does look at this to make sure that they're righting the wrongs of individuals is given as much opportunity to create a sense of fairness and a sense of rebuilding these young children, mostly young children's lives. But as the Attorney General, you are required to oversee whether a system that has been put in is enforced, whether the laws and the regulations are being enforced to make sure we're protecting our children. And you're also required to make sure that people are being treated fairly and equally. And that is a delicate balance that has to happen. But the fact is that the safety of our children, the safety of our families who have been wronged for so many years is vital to us moving ahead as a state. And Baltimore City, by the way, again, this is a Baltimore City issue much more than everywhere else in the entire state because of the age of our housing stock. And I don't think that people outside of our region really understand how entrenched this issue is in what's going on in our city.
So I have some issues outside of Baltimore to ask you, but first outside the Baltimore arena to ask you. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Charles, you're on the air with Delegate John Cardin.
I'd like to ask a question. I've heard what he's going to do about certain issues, but I haven't heard how he's going to actually solve those issues. So what I would like to hear is the candidate select any issues that he'd like to discuss and tell us how he's going to solve that problem.
Okay. Sure. We can talk. What do you want to talk about, Mark? Anything in particular?
Why don't you talked earlier about you were going to be aggressive about issues with guns and violence. What exactly will you do? I mean, rather than saying, oh, we know we can work with the federal government, we can work with the city police, what exactly will you do as AG?
Sure. Well, this is a pretty easy one. First of all, we're going to force our police officers to use the best practices that they can from across the country, and we're going to study that, and we're going to figure out, and we're going to educate them on how to make sure that happens. Because I will tell every single state's attorney, all 24 of them across the – and then this is something that I will do. I will tell them, if you bring me a case that's polluted with racial profiling, I will refuse to take it to appeal. And that will require them to use absolutely their best practices to make sure they are not doing something that is not going to stick because it can't stick if it's unconstitutional the way they're handling it. In terms of the illegal gun trade, you know, we had a bill, and I'm going to work on trying to get that bill passed that would dedicate all of the tax revenue of gun sales and of bullet sales to making sure that we close the loophole to allow the people distributing, the gun owner, the gun sellers, to distribute their guns before a background check is done. That is how you make sure that these people don't get guns. 364 guns have gone to people who do not, who are not permitted to have them because we don't have the background checks done in the 7 days they're required to be done. And then we got to, and so I will direct my Attorney General, my Assistant Attorney General of State Police, my Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, to say if that you got to figure out a way to get these background checks done, or we got to get you enough money to get the staff there. And that's what I'll do, because the safety of our individuals is far more important than the political latitudes and the policy platitudes that we're talking about.
So there's an issue here in the state's attorney's race has to do with victims of sexual assault. And the law in Maryland makes it very difficult to convict perpetrators of sexual assault and rape in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't combine the cases. You can't put the people together. You can't say, well, this has a man who's been accused of this case, this case, this case. These were all the defendants. These are the cases. So the jury sees them separately. It allows a lot of people to be getting off, which is happening right now in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. People are trying to change the law so it fits the federal law. What does an attorney general do about that?
Well, first of all, the attorney general has to make sure that that the laws are enforced and the regulations are enforced. And that's where his primary jurisdiction is on this matter. But rape kits are not being properly used by our state's attorneys and by our
But the people are trying to push that we get the same laws you have in the federal government, the federal laws, so
sure.
That we can more easily go after people with sexual predators.
So if you want to be me to directly answer that question, we have to use the bully pulpit, our legislative office, to make sure that we have the laws in there that we can then enforce there, because the state laws are not as strong as the federal laws. And many of my colleagues, including Delegate Brave Boy, who I will continue to work with, if I am fortunate enough to be the Attorney General, I will see to it that that I can use her perspective, because she has been a leader on trying to change these laws, as I have been a supporter of much of that legislation as co-sponsor. But let me just say that one of the things that I have focused on is sexual assault on college campuses. By the way, you are nearly one in four women are likely to experience sexual assault on college campuses today, because we have not yet figured out a way to make our campuses safe. We need to push our college campuses and our universities to realize that this is a problem and to make our college campuses safe, because it's not just about creating adequate education like the HBCUs issue, but a safe environment in which we can learn.
We only have a few minutes left. They're trying to get a question here, but let's go to the phones. Clarence in Baltimore, very quick thought.
Yes, I'd like to know if the Attorney General's, if you view your job as part of investigating whether or not renters' rights, whether in public or private housing, are being violated by policies set down by the federal government. What is your view on those policies?
Okay.
Thank you.
Good question. Violations of state law or state regulations, it is certainly in our jurisdiction. If there's a violation of federal law, then we certainly can work with our federal authorities to help assist in investigations. And there is nothing that would stop me from doing that, because, again, our renters as well as our landlords need to be treated both fairly and also enforced in the law. So I would have no problem working in conjunction with my federal authorities in joint jurisdiction. Absolutely.
So, very tight situation here. We only have a couple minutes left, but that given all the lawsuits that have happened before, will this next attorney general, if it's you, go after farmers and maybe even say we should go after integrators who own these chickens for in terms of polluting Chesapeake Bay, and what will your in terms of the Clean Water Act, and how will you use
sure.
that?
Well, we need to, first of all, obviously upholding the Clean Water Act and upholding the state laws is of primary importance. In fact, is why I got into the legislature in the first place back in 2002. I ran because I wanted to create an environment that's safer and better than what it was when I got in. And the fact is that we need to do a better job of investigating and working and mediating solutions. My environmental crimes policy is threefold. Number one is education. We need to educate people of what the policies and what the regulations are. Number two, we need to mediate. When there are farmers out there that are trying to work within the regulations, we need to figure out a way to mediate and save money for both the state and for them. And then finally, if they're not going to be bad actors, we're going to, of course, go after them.
So quick question here. Somebody just said it, chatted in quickly. We only have like a minute, half a second to go. We've heard you fight directly with Brian Frost, but what sets you apart from Delegate Brave Boy?
I think Delegate Brave Boy is doing a great job. As a legislator, she's focusing on the issues. She's not focusing on character attacks. And so I've co-sponsored many pieces of legislation that we've worked on together. Some of her priorities are dealing with mass prison issues, dealing with the foreclosure issues, dealing with a number of different civil rights issues, which we share our agendas on. My agenda happens to be about consumer protection, environmental protection, public safety, and civil rights. As chairman of the Election Law Subcommittee, I've spent the last 8 years trying to enfranchise people, get rid of voter ID schemes that are trying to take away people's right to vote. I think Delegate Brave Boy understands that, and I have always had a very good relationship with her.
But you're voting for John Carden, I take it up.
I believe that John Carden is the best person, the only person from Baltimore, and I'm asking everybody to consider voting for me for Attorney General.
Delegate John Carden, thanks so much for joining us. We've had our last one-on-one conversation. The debate will be here on the show Friday. I'm reminding you before we leave here to join us tomorrow night for the Food Town Hall gathering called Donating Well. How can we donate in ways that enrich our community in terms of food and the rights to food? It's in partnership with the CLF Food and Faith Project and Interfaith Power and Light. It will be tomorrow night, June 12th at 7 p.m. at the Franciscan Center at 101 West 23rd. Just join us there and please be part of that conversation. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Marvonis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Alex Boston, Taylor Littlejohn, and Sianna Greaves. To hear this show again, podcast our past shows, link to the works that our guests have written and talked about, as well as the campaigns we've talked about, just go to steinershow.org. All the links will be there. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. We have our own Mark Steiner Show app. So for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, that's Hazel Scott, body and soul. It's her birthday, and I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.